right, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. I'm your host, Bryce, as always, joined by Brendan, my co-host. How are you doing, my friend?
Bryce, as per usual, I am doing fantastic, and we're holding it down here in the world of crypto.
Never missing a beat, never missing a beat. Things are good. We're in a bull market. Sure, maybe a little bit of a correction, but it's just a correction, a short-term correction against a longer-term uptrend. I think there's going to be many dips. I think there's going to be many dips along the way in this bull market. But man, I'm excited to talk about crypto options, crypto derivatives, and Swap Global with their founder, their co-founder, Yev Feldman, today, who's joining us on the Crypto 101 podcast. So, Yev, how are you doing today?
Doing great. Another bright and sunny day in crypto. Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, man, we're excited. And hey, it's not every day that we get to speak with crypto options experts and folks who are deep in the derivative space of crypto. And reason being is there's just not many of you. You guys are like unicorns. There's just not that many places to trade crypto options, at least for folks who are in the States. Sure, out of the States, they're in jurisdictions that I don't want to say have their shit together, but in jurisdictions that are less incumbent, that are more flexible, that are they've got options regimes that are built out for the everyday person, basically. So I think a lot of our listeners here at Crypto 101, they want to learn about options. They want to get their hands on them. They want to know, but it's not here yet. So we want to bridge that gap. We want to, you know, kind of show everybody, what the crypto options world is about. And that's what this episode is going to be about. But before we dive into that, we want to get a little up to speed with who you are and, what were you doing before you founded Swap Global?
Yeah, interesting story. So I was a TradFi guy for about a decade of my life. Started my career 2010 at Bank of America, and I was working in the equities division there. And in 2019, I was very lucky to join what my partner from my boss from Bank of America. He joined a company that was very small at the time, up and coming, called BlockFi. And he was one of the first people there. And I was doing BlockFi stuff in 2018, still at Bank of America, just to basically help out my friends as I viewed them there. So I was taking out loans against my Bitcoins to help drive business with tiny amounts. And then in 2019, I got to join that company, and it was an absolutely incredible experience. When I joined, it was the entire crypto space was still extremely small. In my opinion, crypto is still small. I think the ETF space is the event is the first time that I could honestly say that it's become big, just in terms of how many new participants that it can bring in. But at the time in 2019, the space was super small, and you would go to a party in New York or London, right? And it's going to be the same people every single night. The only thing that would change is the mood, which depended on the price. So at the time, this was summer 2019, right? BlockFi was one of the first kind of, I would say, experiments almost of doing more with your crypto. People figured out, look, I can send my, I can send my crypto to various institutions, and those institutions can do different things with it. So we kind of built out that book of business. From when I joined, it was $15 million, I want to say. We had Gemini dollars that people kind of just sent to us. And one of the earliest stories there was when Ether was added to the BlockFi platform, no one knew what would happen to that as a product. And the first day, some kind of almost random hedge fund just sent like $20 million of Ether, which was 10 times more than the entire assets of BlockFi. And I think the founders of BlockFi just kind of called them and said, hey, like, can you guys just take this back for a while? So those were the days of really discovery in the market. And we, as that book of business grew, the balance sheet of BlockFi grew from 15 million to 50 to 100 to a billion. That team had to go and figure out different things to do with those coins. And, it was an extremely sad story in the end. Kind of along the way, that was the business that we built up. was all sorts of financing, derivatives transactions. This was way before kind of Alameda FTX entered any kind of picture. And it was an absolutely incredible time. Left that in 2022, early 2022. And me and my partner, Renee Van Kesteren, we saw a need from BlockFi to go and build out an institutional component that was kind of missing, which was swaps and derivatives, OTC for US folks, and raise some money to go do that. And we're still at it.
That's epic. And actually, you know, this definitely is not going to be an episode on BlockFi or anything. I am curious, though, like, you know, what happened there? I think a lot of our listeners did use BlockFi, Celsius, Voyager, one of those. People are like, where'd the money go, right? And so was it, at the end of the day, did Sam Bankman-Fried, who's now in jail for all this fraud and stuff, was it that he borrowed a bunch of this money that just he never ended up paying back, and BlockFi users were who he was borrowing from? Or is it more nuanced?
Yeah, every story is nuanced, but you know, sometimes too much nuance is unnecessary. So I think the short answer is yes. I think the long answer is if you've got a $20 billion balance sheet, which mid-July 2021, BlockFi was, right?
Wow.
And and it's an interest-bearing balance sheet that's paying 6%, that's $1.2 billion of interest expense, or you can also call it customer acquisition cost. How are you gonna make $1.2 billion to, you know, be profitable? I mean, even in 2021, you couldn't just raise $2 billion from VCs, right? You could raise a few hundred million. So you have to be quite mindful. And I think what kind of happened was that business can be super sustainable and scalable, $500 million balance sheet, $1 billion balance sheet, maybe even $5 billion, I don't know. But once you get into $20 billion, I mean, that's crazy numbers. If you make a loan and you lose, you know, you make a loan and you that loan goes to zero, you're going from $5 million loss, live and learn, to you know, $500 million loss that you cannot cover that loss. People lose money and people's lives are hurt or destroyed, right? And that's kind of horrible. So combination of factors, super nuanced, I think got way too big. And levers that could have been pulled, like not paying interest or taking less risk, pulled way too late. And that's how you get into a situation where you end up with something like Alameda and FTX, which was its own story, right? That you just get dragged into.
Yeah, crazy. Yeah, it's a wild story. But you know, one of the things that's cool about what we get to do here is that we pull people in from all backgrounds, right? Old, young, people with TradFi backgrounds, people that are crypto natives. And so I'm sure there's some people that are kind of listening in and wondering, what's some of the key differences between decentralized derivatives and maybe the traditional counterpart to that? Because there's probably people who have experience doing traditional options and traditional derivatives, and they're listening to this and wondering, you know, is there any kind of overlap here? You know, if I'm familiar with this in the traditional sense, am I going to be familiar with the decentralized version of this as well? So is there any overlap there?
I think the common theme across derivatives and options specifically is that they're almost always mispriced from the buyer's point of view. Mm. And you can, as a buyer, you can sometimes take advantage of that. But I think a traditional, you know, experienced person would kind of look at the crypto market and say, I always want to sell these derivatives, right? They're always kind of too expensive. And usually that'll work out great, probably even better than in trad world. That's kind of just unspoken rule is that the, you know, the options in crypto are going to be even more mispriced than in traditional world. I mean, recently there was like even these Bloomberg stories about, you know, options traders in India that are powering like $1 billion revenue powerhouse businesses for traditional market makers, right? Through these lawsuits that came out. So you can imagine crypto is kind of a marketplace like that. So I think for traditional participants, they wouldn't see anything new. It's kind of what they expect, just supercharged. The main difference is it's so much harder to access in a way that most people would be comfortable with.
Yeah. So what would you say that like some of the big opportunities that the decentralized derivative market creates that can exist in the traditional side?
I think just speaking about crypto specifically, I think that the amount of, you know, I'm not a market maker, but I think that the amount of legwork that you would have to put in to kind of run a market making book profitably on crypto options is still a lot lower than in traditional space. And I'm not talking about DeFi protocols or stuff like that. I mean, that there's ARBs that exist between decentralized options protocols and CeFi options protocols that people run. Yeah, I think the amount of legwork you just have to put in is way lower, because in traditional space, you're still competing with, you know, your Jane Streets, your Jumps. And in options space right now, that's still a little bit less, right? So you can, I think you can still even click trade in certain cases, right? And you can run a market making strategy that way. Know people that are doing that. So there's opportunities, but you do have to be comfortable taking a different kind of risk in crypto, because it's not the ETF, right?
Yeah, and this is still 24/7, right? Because there are, you know, like futures. You look at like CME futures for Bitcoin, and those aren't 24/7. You got trading hours that you got to abide by. But this is a little bit different, right? These are still 24/7. You know, it still has 24/7 availability, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Well, and tell us one of those, you know, you're talking about assets being mispriced or options being mispriced. What does that mean?
Basically, just means if you you go to buy an option, how likely are you to be, you know, profitable from it at expiry? What's the probability of that? And that probability is generally quite low, because the amount of VIG that a dealer charges for selling you that option is going to eat into a ton of that probability in the first place. And then you have the actual probability of the market moving in your favor. So in traditional markets, you kind of, most market makers are going to be selling options and then hedging. And in crypto, it's even stronger than that, right? In terms of, you're very unlikely to profit just by buying an option. But on the other end, it's crypto, right? So when you have these moves and things go up, everyone loves it, right? Everyone loves to see, well, I did the thing that I'm not supposed to do, and I made money from it, right? That's what kind of the mindset is. And that's what we love about crypto, is crypto is unlikely. It's not supposed to succeed. I'm not supposed to buy it. I'm not supposed to make money from it. Options, you're really not supposed to do that usually, because of the way that they're priced, and it's super complex, and the people that are selling them to you are very sophisticated. But when you add crypto and options, derivatives generally, right, perps, it's even more like that, right? It's like, I'm buying the instrument I'm not supposed to buy in the asset I'm not supposed to buy, and actually I'm going to make money from it. I'm going to prove you wrong. And, you know, sometimes that happens. And that's what's beautiful about this space, is that I think everyone kind of believes in this space, both for fundamental reasons and just culturally, I think we love it. You can also, like, as a market maker, you can profit in crypto by just doing what you know how to do. But, you know, sometimes you can just buy the option and Bitcoin's going to go from 15K to 70K, right? And you're going to get to do the wrong thing twice, which you cannot do in the traditional space. But, there's smarter ways to play that in options for sure. Right. Sometimes you don't want to just buy it outright. Maybe you want to buy like a call spread, or you want to, you know, maybe you want to do basis plus you want to sell a put or something. Right. So there's, people can do all sorts of things, but, that's what's fun.
Yeah. And, you know, the more I think about it, I kind of want to dive into that, a little bit more, options not really being something that people should be buying. But you're building a platform that people will be trading options on. So tell me a little bit about this, this dynamic here.
We want to give US like institutional investors access to derivatives and options market in a wrapper that they know and that they're familiar with. Because at the end of the day, a lot of US fund type of people, call it like whether it's macro PMs, whether it's just larger family offices, smaller funds, options, they're very much aware that just buying options, you're really just paying a market maker some VIG, and it's going to most likely expire worthless. But options can be a super valuable tool for portfolio construction, right? Like, the very famous story of this was at the end of 2017, when Block Tower basically sold a ton of their Bitcoin and did call replacement, right? Where they bought call options, which were, I don't remember what the strikes were, probably like 50K, or like, because the terminal price of that cycle was 20K, right?
Right.
And those expired worthless, but they got to reduce a ton of their spot exposure they spent, I don't know, 2% or 1% of AUM on basically these lotto tickets, right, that I'm sure they structured intelligently. So instead of riding down kind of 2018 being down 50%, 70%, like a ton of funds were and had to shut down, they, you know, they paid some market maker. They got like that crazy upside that you sometimes get in crypto, and it's great to get. And they're still around and like crushing it today. So something like that's super useful, or more tactical things than that even.
Interesting. Yeah. Shout out to Ari Paul, CIO, I think, over there at Block Tower. I remember when he came out and said that, and people were like, thinking like, oh my gosh, like you just bought, like, I think it was like, yeah, 50K calls or 100K calls or something. He's like, I'm actually doing it as like a defensive maneuver. And people were like, people were too stupid back then to understand actually what he was doing. But yeah, that's why he's the one with the $1 billion fund and nobody else is, right?
I think that's the tactical side of when you're managing money, that you need a variety of instruments to feel comfortable managing that money. And sometimes you're going to use it. So you don't want to be, unless you have someone on your team that's like super experienced with options, which is kind of a specialty hire. Not a lot of funds have that. They're mm-hmm. definitely out there that can spot like mispricings and things like this. You do want it as a tactical instrument, right? And we've seen it also like even in this range from 60 to 70K, people just treat it as levered spot exposure, basically, right? People are like, I think it's going to bounce between 60 yeah. and 70K. I'm going to buy some call spreads when it's close to 60, and I'm going to close them out when it's close to 70. And, you know, instead of having like plus 10, 20% P&L days, you know, it's like plus 100, 200% P&L days. And that's just the return profile that PM wants for that stage of fund growth, right? And right. without options, it's hard to achieve that. You can achieve that with perps. Perps are hard to access also. You can also get liquidated.
You know, historically, why has this been so hard to get access to in the US?
The story has always been Deribit to a large extent, which you can't talk about Deribit without talking about BitMEX, right? Because it was really the BitMEX event where, mm-hmm. and this is kind of still ongoing, where you had kind of US folks, right, that were trading on these offshore venues that changed over time, right? And that got caught up in AML/KYC, and the facts and circumstances for each venue were different. But basically, US folks cannot really trade on Deribit anymore unless they go through a huge effort to open an offshore office and put in place policies and procedures, and then the offshore venue has to be comfortable with that as well. Some are, some aren't. So that all changed kind of around 2020, 2021, and certainly like with FTX and now, you know, Binance, like, investors yeah. are very careful about how they're doing that. And at the same time, you have not seen the evolution that much of options and even futures markets to some extent in the US, because you have so many kind of onerous requirements for use of margin and use of cash, to the extent like it's not like that it makes it safer, because sometimes you want to use your coins as collateral, right? But you cannot necessarily do that in the context of US commodities regs. And the cash markets have not grown nearly as much as people would have kind of expected, right? So CME futures are amazing product. Options on CME futures, still clunky because you have to go through FCMs that not everybody wants to go through or not everyone has a relationship with. And there's so many reasons that people just kind of give up. But swaps is like an easier type of process, at least from our experience, right? It's still risky, right, from a counterparty perspective, still complex, but it's a tactical way for people to get something they need today. And if there do become options on the ETF, right, that would be a huge solve for this, right? But it's a question if that's going to happen or not.
Yeah, it looks like the jury is unfortunately still out on that. Still not decided. Looks like the SEC is kind of dragging their feet. Looks like they're also kind of dragging their feet on the Ethereum ETF. And you know, here I'm, you know, one of the questions that I was thinking of was like, you know, when are we going to be able to trade zero DTE options on Dogecoin, like on Robinhood? It's like, man, if we can't even get like, you know, options on Bitcoin ETFs approved, we are a long ways away from like the fun stuff, it sounds like.
That's the funny thing is the holy grail is the US market, right? Because US market, God bless America. This is one of the things that makes America great, is that people are allowed to make bets, right? So all of these, I feel like a lot of these offshore kind of venues and things become less relevant once you have more instruments that trade on U.S. markets, whether it's more ETFs on more underlyings, whether it's derivatives on the exchange traded derivatives on underlyings, like options on the ETFs, right? And one day, I mean, things trend differently, but one day you'll have those things, right? It's inevitable over the coming 10, 20 years, right? It's just how markets evolve. The American market will kind of dwarf all the others. Like it's the holy grail for kind of people that love markets, people that love to see what markets can do and the behavior that people express. I mean, there's a lot to love there. Obviously you want everyone to make money and not to make bad choices. Right. So there's the aspect of gambling that's totally understandable. You don't necessarily want sometimes people to trade, with puts against Dogecoins or whatever calls or whatever. But that's what markets are for. It's for markets to determine what's right and wrong.
Absolutely. So, Yev, walk us through what you're building at Swap Global. I mean, is this for the everyday crypto 101 listener who's at home? You know, kind of wants to go tinker around and learn options and kind of at that level? Or is this really for institutional folks who are, you know, they're already, you know, well ingrained into options trading, and this is just going to be a new extension for them?
I think it's super interesting for people in crypto to hear what institutions are doing in this kind of opaque space that's way more opaque than OTC spot. Mm-hmm. It has driven markets in the past. It will again in the future. Ultimately, as depending on what your profile is, likely this may not be appropriate for you, right? Like this is really for institutional investors. This is really for hedge funds, family offices, high net worth kind of people, right? Because there are requirements in the U.S. for who can access this kind of product. Also, the risk on facing, we're a venture-backed, automated electronic derivatives dealer for crypto, right? Say that fast. You don't want...
Can't even repeat it.
Yeah. You don't want most people to be using that.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a ton of sense. And you know, it sounds like, you know, folks who are out there, you know, folks do, you know, listen to the podcast who run funds and who are looking for, you know, options exposure. I think people should definitely check out Swap Global. You know, what are our ways, you know, maybe if we take a step back for the everyday person to like look at the options market and maybe not trade in the options market, maybe not say, okay, I'm going to go buy this put, sell this call, whatever, but look at the data. Is there anything that's like an easy way to kind of see what the markets are going to be doing by looking at options data?
I think if you look at data from that perspective, I think open interest on futures is much more interesting than open interest on markets, on options.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Yeah. I think, just if you aggregate open interest, I mean, I think at this point everyone is doing, well, to me, it feels like everyone is doing this, but I feel like everyone should be doing this. You know, if you go to some of these services that do this basically for free, you can set up dashboards, right? If you look at things like open interest on Bitcoin that's aggregated across venues, and you compare that to, you know, maybe some of your favorite altcoins, whether it's Doge, whether, you know, it's LTC, whatever, I think that's a great way to grasp where the market is going. I mean, other things that people look at are things like open interest relative to market cap. Right, because open interest will trend up over time because the market cap of the coins will trend up, so naturally it can be the same percentage. That's much more interesting. So people also look at funding rates, which I think are less, have proven themselves to be less and less useful in terms of kind of being either cyclical or countercyclical indicators. They're just kind of like at this point, funding rates just kind of exist, and like if you want to earn the funding, do a basis trade. You know, call us. We're happy to help swap you into something like that if it's appropriate. But the actual open interest, I feel like is there's still only a certain amount, right, of even with the spot ETF, there's still only a certain amount of kind of leverage on the futures instruments that can support relative to spot buying. And I really don't think that options, you know, you can, like, you never know why people put on options positions. You never know what the other side is. it's still small relative to the total market. I don't think it really drives the market. I don't think like gamma hedging or something drives the market.
Right. And you know, open interest is something that, you know, we don't actually discuss much on the show. So that actually might even be a new term for a lot of listeners. Could you kind of unpack that and then maybe what's the actionable sort of signal that, you know, you might learn from looking at open interest? You know, open interest is too high relative to spot buying, so it's a sell signal, or what is it and what do you look for?
Totally. Aggregate open interest would be the sum of all the open interest on every derivatives venue. So things like BitMEX, things like Binance, Deribit, OKX.
The sum of like all the bids or the sum of all the bets, basically.
Yeah, the sum of all the bets. And why it's interesting specifically relative to like how many coins are on Coinbase is because in general, that's all leverage. Open interest is going to be leverage versus spot is cash buyers with long or short duration period. Mm-hmm. And the thing about leverage is it gets liquidated sooner or later, voluntarily or involuntarily. It's got to come out. You're not going to pay funding forever. So as far as I've never met someone in crypto that started paying funding, you know, in 2017 and is still paying for it, right? Something happened, right? They closed that position or it got closed for them. And open interest, particularly now, there's no more BlockFi, Celsius, any of these institutions that used to lever up your coins, right? Even the ETF, you can't really lever up yet. That's a great indication of leverage in the system. I don't believe that it's the same thing as froth because leverage will always be there. It's just that at certain points you can see how much open, you can almost chart it like you would price, right? You can almost chart it like, okay, like we're going to bounce off like the 8 billion aggregate open interest or something, right? But a more, you know, and people really do this with models that are much better. They can really track every single order that's open. If it's levered buy, levered sell, they can even estimate kind of what the leverage was and where people's liquidations are, levels are. So serious people are very advanced about this. They're not charting it like that. But I mean, anyone can go, you know, there's two websites that provide this data almost for free. You can just add the indicator aggregate open interest on Bitcoin. You can add another indicator for open interest relative to market cap. And you can just look historically what happened to price when those levels have been above or below something. And it doesn't mean it'll happen again, but it's a great way to understand kind of where you are in the market today, like to get your bearings, the same way that I wouldn't buy Bitcoin without looking at a chart of Bitcoin versus the S&P 500, right? Like it's great that Bitcoin's at an all-time high. It's not an all-time high relative to the S&P 500. So you want to kind of know where your bearings are. Open interest is great for that, much better than anything in options.
No, I think that makes total sense. And you know, we always have people kind of coming to us and being like, I'm interested in the crypto markets, but I have so many questions. So what kind of advice would you have for people who are interested in investing or maybe even trading the crypto markets for the first time, but they're just not as familiar with it?
It's, I mean, you got to just dip your toes in the water. It's wonderful that there's resources like this because it's not just about learning or being part of a community. It's also just seeing, I don't want to say joy, but, you know, crypto, it's a very interesting thing, right? It's a very interesting economic development. It's very easy to participate in it. You just need $10 and you can go buy some. So there's every reason to get into it. And it's, you know, it's the same thing as everything else in human nature, which is there's no, you know, if you're the type of person that gets carried away with things, that can be good or bad, right? It can be a new hobby or it can be a financial disaster for you. So be mindful. But it's a lot of fun.
It's certainly,
yeah. And it gets volatile, right? You know, that's the one thing that I always like to tell people is that the crypto markets are amazing. And typically over the long term, the volatility plays in our favor. Just look at Bitcoin's past performance, look at Ethereum's past performance. But there's constantly a battle of some people on one side saying, hey, you need to be looking at fundamentals all the way. Then you have people on another corner that are saying, no, it's all technicals, it's all charts, it's all indicators. You need to be paying attention to this instead. So I'm kind of curious to get your opinion on the matter. You know, is it a world of fundamentals? Is it a world of technicals? Or is there a happy place in between where both can be used for useful data?
I'm going to have to answer that question by going back to my experience at BlockFi. Where I was, you know, in a way I was lucky because as the business grew, I got to take orders for a lot of people, right? So even for someone like Three Arrows, right? And you talk about fundamentals and technicals, right? I would see people, I would take orders for people that are putting on levered positions for, you know, $2, $3 billion. And then I see a tweet about why, you know, Ethereum is fundamentally weak. Right. And, you know, sometimes they would be short Ethereum. Sometimes they would be long Ethereum to the tune of billions of dollars. And then I would see like another tweet like a month later where, you know, the same kind of counterparty would bounce to a technical analysis of why, you know, the open interest is like overheated. Right. We're going to something like with regulatory actions or something like this. And they would completely flip. And I think one inevitably drives the other. The interesting thing is I think that behavior across, I think I've seen that to generalize across a wide range of kind of buyers and sellers in crypto, is that you can get drawn in on the fundamental side of exploring things and switch to a technical aspect, and it drives you the other way sooner or later, because you do have to like get in and out, right? And sometimes flip. So, you know, both are super valid. Probably, you know, you probably want to do both during any cycle. Otherwise, you're going to have less fun.
Do you think that's changed over the years at all? Like kind of as the crypto markets have evolved, maybe it used to be dominated by, let's just say, technicals, or it used to be dominated by fundamentals. And then as the market cap has grown, as crypto has become more mainstream, you know, maybe there's some people that would argue the technicals are more important now than ever, because now you have Bitcoin as a $1 trillion asset, where it used to, you know, in prior cycles, maybe just be millions and then billions and now trillions. You know, have you seen anything like that?
I think to your point, exactly. I think the most important thing is, what is Bitcoin's market cap relative to global financial assets?
Yeah.
You know, that numbers keep going up, right? That's both technical and fundamental. So easy way to track that, just look at Bitcoin relative to SPY, you know, TradingView BTC divided by SPY. And that's really both fundamental and technical, right? Because it's got to go above the all-time high. And when it does, you know, the reality is that, yeah, fundamentally, this becomes an asset that is super useful for wealth, becomes an asset that takes more and more of the world's wealth, right? It's not going to take 100%. It's not, you know, whatever your thoughts are about the monetary system and all this, but it captures, exactly.
There
it captures a larger, yeah.
Long-term. For those who are following along on video on YouTube, here's what a Bitcoin looks like priced in terms of S&P 500. And he's right. We haven't broken above the all-time high yet. But it looks like a pretty good trend. You know, zoomed out, you kind of turn on logarithmic. I mean, that is that's a long-term growth trend. Great idea. I truly didn't really think to chart Bitcoin in terms of the SPY. Sometimes I see it like Bitcoin in terms of oil or gold or in terms of other currencies and stuff. But yeah, in terms of the SPY, I mean, hey, that's the real benchmark, right? I mean, that's the real benchmark that you're trying to beat at the end of the day.
It's so being a markets practitioner, one of the most funny things is eventually I just started thinking about everything in terms of pairs. So whenever I go to buy Apple, I think about it as the Apple USD. I don't think about it as shares of Apple anymore.
Right.
I think if you think of every asset on a relative basis, you start USD, you work down to SPY, you figure out what the denominator is. I think that's a much more insightful conversation. People are like, do you denominate in ETH or like in Bitcoin? You must denominate in the asset that's larger today to figure out where you are. You have no choice. But thinking about that for all assets, mm-hmm. I think it's a great financial decision. I think it's helpful to balance your portfolio.
I got to know, like, you know, as somebody like yourself, you've traded, you know, billions and billions of dollars of crypto through spot derivatives, all sorts of stuff. So, you know, just walk us through kind of what that looks like. A trader like, you know, Three Arrows, you know, which was at the peak, the largest, you know, crypto hedge fund of all time, like billions and billions of dollars. So they come in and they say, hey, like, I want to buy $1 billion worth of Bitcoin. And he's not going to go on Coinbase himself and you know, start to, you know, type in, you know, one Bitcoin at a time and keep clicking buy. He's going to tell a guy like you, go do this for me. You can make a little bit of money from it. So what do you do? Like, how do you go out and fulfill this order? Like, how do you do that? What happens?
It's such, well, this particular case was such a funny story because we had so much balance sheet at BlockFi that we let people trade and settle later. So you take kind of market risk on that. And I remember one of the largest orders we took for Three Arrows. And look, you got to understand, this was, first of all, we had collateral from them in the form of GBTC shares, which, you know, right, you can apply some margining haircut on. But at the time, it was like 200. It was a lot. Like, yeah, but this in itself was a funny story in that we took like a $500 million order or a $1 billion order. And then I think we went to them and said, how do you want to settle this? Meaning, how are you going to send us the dollars? And they said, can you guys actually just lend us the money? And we said, absolutely, that's great. That's a swap, by the way. That is literally a swap. And for us as a business, that's fantastic because that means we're going to make a financing rate on that order of $1 billion. We can charge, even we can charge them 10%. We're effectively lending
it's your money.
$100 million in revenue. And then you have to get the risk metrics according, which for BlockFi, the issue with the risk side was not these kinds of collateralized things. It was more token, Serum, FTX on collateralized lending. This is great business for any broker that can get it because you need a party that wants to take risk. You get financing revenue. But to answer your question on the trading side, you know, these days Coinbase bought Tagomi. They have kind of world-class trading product for institutions that want to run algos. So if you want to go and you want to buy right now 1 billion, 2 billion of Bitcoin, Coinbase is your place to do it. I mean, you literally can just click a button. You can run a TWAP. Even that TWAP is such a crypto thing. Like in traditional finance, everyone does VWAPs, but because VWAPs are slightly harder to build from an algo perspective, like not much, but slightly, everyone did TWAPs for the longest time in crypto, like literally until 2022 when Coinbase rolled out VWAP, which is time weighted versus volume weighted. And usually the price is not that different. You should run a VWAP. It's a little cleaner, but TWAP is easier to understand because you're basically just buying one coin every minute, for example. That's a very basic type of TWAP. VWAP is you're estimating how many coins you think are going to trade in that minute, and then you buy the appropriate amount. But yeah, today, I think that the OTC business is much more of a driver for other businesses, whether it's custody. For Coinbase, it's the exchange, right? And it's facing off against retail that use the exchange product. But in the past, OTC, the game for OTC desk was actually largely to pick up people like BlockFi, their retail customers, to pick up people like Robinhood, right? Like Jump had that relationship for a long time. Because with that kind of retail flow, it can start, and I saw this, right? It starts and all of a sudden it grows like 10, 50, 100x in terms of people just clicking buy button. You know, this is what happened end of 2020. And if you're an OTC desk market maker and you have that flow coming to you, it's amazing because it's much easier to predict, right? You're typically not going to lose money on it, as opposed to if you take an order for an institution, you don't know what's on the other end of it. And it's great to offset with other flows because often you'll have people selling into this, right? So today, I think most institutions are going to go to something like Coinbase, Elwood, Talos. They can plug into what they need, and you can. It's amazing the infrastructure that's built out. You can really trade spot easily, but a lot of the reason really people traded with BlockFi and Genesis was really for that leverage. They didn't want to settle. Sometimes they wouldn't even tell you ahead of time they don't want to settle. They would just trade and then say, I'm not settling. You're going to lend me the money.
Wow. Crazy. Well, it's good. It's good that that is now, you know, being regulated and all that stuff, so it doesn't happen again. You know, the whole blow up and the daisy chain liquidations and, well, he's not paying me, so I can't pay you, so you can't pay him, and the whole thing, right? But there needs to be a replacement for that liquidity, for that, you know, capital. Do you see anybody kind of coming in to fill that void? Is it going to be the big banks? Is it going to be, I mean, who's it going to be, right?
It's such an interesting question. I think an amazing example of this, and this is like, I don't know if this is like super bullish for whenever this happens, but if you look at something like the ETF, mm-hmm. Right, excluding Grayscale, $15 billion of inflows so far.
Crazy.
You cannot, right? It's amazing. I would have never predicted that. if you want to borrow against that ETF, I mean, that's basically what some of these people did. it's hard to do that, right? Like Robinhood, I think you can borrow. Maybe Interactive Brokers, you can borrow against your ETF, mm-hmm. your crypto ETF. I'm not sure if that's going to be available long term, to be honest. I'm not sure if other brokers will have that. Like, I don't think Fidelity has that, even though Fidelity has an ETF. So, yeah, to your point, it's kind of to be seen. Will spot holdings kind of move over to the ETF? If they do, how are you going to lever up against that? Actually, is it good for you to lever up against that? That's a whole other question. But it may just be that some of these things are replaced, right? Like, you know, one of the reasons that Ethereum in 2021 had this huge run, honestly, people were just buying it on leverage through BlockFi and Genesis, like probably $5 to $10 billion. But we see now you didn't need that, right? It was just there's enough now spot demand to buy it, and now with the ETF flows, that leverage kind of has been, we're at the same price, but with much less lever trading, unless there's like something like out there that we don't know about, right? Sometimes these things come out like a year later where it's like, oh, that was something concentrated there that was buying on leverage, shouldn't have been. It's just been replaced by natural spot buying, right? And it just goes back to that chart relative to SPY, which is that Bitcoin and crypto in general is just taking up more and more of the world's financial assets. There's a cap somewhere, but the spot buying will continue. You don't need leverage to supercharge it to 200K or whatever. It will get there eventually. It just becomes bigger in the scheme of world's assets.
Yeah.
How do you think that the ETF dynamic kind of affects the crypto markets going forward? And, you know, you just alluded to this a second ago, but previously it was super easy for people to take profits from Bitcoin and then immediately inject those into the next altcoin investment or to the next speculative cryptocurrency. But it's a little bit different now because with the ETFs being here, it's a lot harder to go from, you know, the Grayscale or the Fidelity ETF into your favorite altcoin that's on the rise, you know, because you're not trading on a crypto exchange anymore. And so I've seen a lot of people talk about this and say that it's going to affect the way that crypto market cycles work and maybe how cryptocurrencies flow into altcoins afterwards. And I'm just curious to get your thoughts on this, because I still think that, you know, obviously altcoins are getting a lot of attention. They have a bright future. There's going to be a bunch of great projects that come onto the rise, you know, this year, 10 years from now, et cetera. But it does seem like a little bit of the dynamic has changed.
It's such an interesting question, right? Because it's always a question of how much, you know, how much money is really going to be in the space to buy things that are not easy to buy.
Yeah.
And you can go either way, right? You can go and say, well, historically, that's always been a great opportunity when you can buy something that's not easy to buy, because eventually it becomes easy to buy. Mm-hmm. Right. Even with something like Dogecoin, like, you know, would you want to bet that there's not going to be a Doge ETF in our lifetime, or like that even ETFs will change, you know, like, there's some probability to that, right? Like, today it's hard to imagine, but so there is a price on all these assets that even if you believe in a future that all the money is going to be an ETF and through traditional rails, there's still a high probability that a ton of assets are going to move onto those rails one way or another in our lifetime, right? So you got to price that in. And, you know, that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is just like, there's a ton of money in the space and way more than there's ever been. And that money is going to flow throughout the ecosystem. And it, by the way, in a much more different and healthy way than in 2021, when, mm-hmm. you know, it was like Alameda was like literally farming like every project, right? And then everyone got like, they were farming all the Solana projects, and then everyone got jealous and started farming Avalanche products, right?
It was chaos.
And nobody knew whose money it was.
Yeah. Oh my God. It was froth, right? I mean, and to your point earlier, I mean, now we're at the same exact price as we were at the last bull market peak, except we're here with way less leverage, way less bad actors, way more quote unquote adults in the room, you know, sustainable capital, collateralized lending, all that kind of stuff. Luna isn't, you know, an overhang. I mean, there's so many things that are more, you know, so much more foundationally strong for this next bull run. So I think that this is going to be an incredible bull run. I think we're in the very, very early innings. You got a long ways to go. I'm really excited to keep tabs on the growth at Swap Global with everything you guys are building, because I think there's a huge need for it. Somebody's got to do it. Somebody's got to do the hard work of building out this infrastructure. And man, after this conversation, I couldn't be more happy and more, you know, bulled up on you being the guy to make this all come together behind the scenes. So, look, yeah, we appreciate your time coming on today. And I hope you enjoyed everything. Where can people kind of find out more and stay in touch with you?
Yeah, it's been such a pleasure to be here. This has been so fun. Just as talking about crypto and derivatives, you can find us really on swapglobal.com. Recommend our insights. Every once in a while, we'll put out something that's super accessible to everyone talking about derivatives. Not too complex, interesting, a little history involved. So swapglobal.com. It's been a blast. Thank you for having me.
Nice. Awesome. Thank you so much, Yev. We hope to have you back on again soon. If there's some big interesting moves in the options world, some big regulations that might, you know, break out this ecosystem, whatever it is, you know, we're always excited to have giga brains on the podcast like yourself. So you let us know when you want to come back and we'll have you on. So everybody at home watching, hope you enjoyed. Check us out on YouTube. If you're on YouTube, check us out on Spotify, wherever. Mix and match the platforms. We'd love to get your likes and subscribes. And we'll talk to everyone soon. Take care.
Wow. What's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.